Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Laura Lee. For years now, we've heard rumors of vast, extensive, sophisticated waterways under the Giza Plateau, that there's more going on under the plateau than on top with the rest of the pyramids of Egypt. We've heard that there are members of an indigenous group that date way, way, way back to some of the first peoples that were in Egypt that are still keeping that knowledge alive, though close to their vest. And now Stephen Mailer, who's an independent Egyptologist who spent years researching this story, has come out with his new book, The Land of Osiris. And he's here to tell us today about what he's found out of the hidden side of Giza. Stephen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Laura. It's great to speak to you again.
Good to talk to you. And where did your story begin with your interest in Egypt?
Well, you know, we say formally I've been studying the subject almost 35 years, but it really goes back to when I was a small boy and just picking up an issue of National Geographic and seeing a picture of the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid. It just fascinated me. It stirred something deep within me, and it's been an interest that's been something that's continued throughout my life and probably will continue. I just feel a very close connection to that civilization.
Tell us about Hakim and how you met him and how he started to reveal this secret knowledge to you.
Yes, well, it became a series of events that led me to him. First studying academic Egyptology and not being satisfied with the paradigms and the answers I was given there, and then going deep into the metaphysical tradition, I discovered that groups like the Rosicrucians, the Masons, the Theosophical Society, they all intimated that their knowledge came from ancient Egypt and that there was a much more sophisticated understanding than was popularly believed. And so it was a series of events, and it was particularly one book by a great author named Murray Hope, who mentioned that there was an indigenous group still living in Egypt who maintained the old ways. And it was also in a contact that I had with a very high-ranking Rosicrucian and indigenous-born Egyptian man named Dr. Albert Das, who told us that the indigenous tradition still existed in Egypt, and my partner and I, we should go find it. And so I went to Egypt, and it'll be 10 years this fall, in 1992, and lo and behold, the man that I was seeking was the tour guide in the group that I was with, and had not yet revealed himself an indigenous wisdom keeper. Abdel Hakim Awyan is his formal name. Everybody knows him as Hakim. He's been a tour guide for almost 50 years. And it's just in the mid-90s that he revealed himself, that he is an indigenous wisdom keeper, that he belongs to a tribe whose responsibility it was not only to keep the history of their own tribe, the history of all tribes that connected with that civilization. And so basically he gave us a hypothesis that the civilization was well over 10,000 years old, that the tradition that he was handing down was a very distinctly African tradition, that of all wisdom keepers who kept the records by rote, by initiation, and well before there was written records, this was the way that histories were kept. And so he has been given permission to reveal these teachings now to the West because of some timing that's involved, the end of cycles that are coming up, and he's given me the permission to reveal these traditions. And we're not the original ones. In my research, I found that fragments of these teachings have been brought forth by many other researchers before, particularly a Frenchman named Thomas Burgoyne, an American named Paul Brunton. These are names that may be familiar to your audience, and of course the great Armenian Greek mystic George Gurdjieff, all intimated that they had had contact with an indigenous tradition in Egypt. But now we have a formal set of teachings that we can bring out to create a paradigm shift, to present new definitions, new understanding, and that the civilization was much, much older than has been previously believed.
And there's some connections here to the Dogon, who are an African tribe that are wisdom keepers of a very old lineage too, aren't they?
Yes, and I believe that the Dogon were actually one of the ancient indigenous tribes that were part of the civilization, and they had this unique knowledge of Sirius, which Robert Temple elucidates in his work, and Hakim agrees with all of that, that there was a deep connection with the star system Sirius.
So tell us a bit to set the stage about this indigenous set of tribes. Did they live along the Nile and where the the Dogon lived? Did they have a widespread system? How sophisticated were they? What was some of their basic knowledge? Where did this technology come from?
Well, that's a great question. What we're taught basically is that what became the civilization, which was known as Kemet, not Egypt.
K-H-E-M-I-T.
That's the spelling we use. Of course, you know, people who study the hieroglyphs know that vowels were not written, so it's usually just written as K-M-T. So we adopt the spelling K-H-E-M-I-T. I usually pronounce Kemet, but most people can't do that, so it's Kemet.
Uh-huh.
And it means the black land. It referred to the dark, rich soil that the Nile deposited that enabled the agricultural basis of the civilization. But what we're told is it's not the Nile as she is today, that the ancient civilization well over 10,000 years ago was based on an older Nile River, which is all today just western desert. And we have tremendous amount of geophysical and climatological evidence to support this, that, in fact, Robert Schock has just recently written something about this, that over 5 to 8,000 years ago, most of what is northern Africa was very lush, very green, and had abundant rainfall, and there was a huge ancient river which was called the Ur-Nil, a German term which means primordial. And this is where the civilization flourished, from the west, from the south. So the Dogon originally were considered to be an area of Libya. They are now in Mali, which is West Africa, but they have moved. Their original ancestral tribal grounds was probably what is Libya today, and that was part of ancient Kemet. So we're talking about 42 tribes that came together. They were all races, all people. And what we're talking about is a time of cycles, and that there was a cycle. That he actually, Hakim dates the beginning of the civilization at 65,000 years ago. No one has stretched it that far, and yet we're getting a lot of corroborating evidence. A lot of things are coming in that we could talk about that are pushing civilization further and further back. But these people, not aliens, not Atlanteans, developed a sophisticated consciousness, ability to work with hard stone, like granite, like diorite, limestone, to be able to cut it like it was butter, be able to shape it, we think, with many sophisticated techniques of engineering science. And these are the people, we say, that built the pyramids, carved the Sphinx, and for many different reasons and purposes than what Egyptology says.
We'll get to those in a bit, but first I want to just mention that the Australian Aborigines claim that their heritage as one contiguous culture goes back 65,000 years.
Absolutely.
I've heard that there's archaeological evidence that can bring it back 140,000 years, so it's not too surprising that there would be other indigenous cultures that can trace back 65,000 years. It's not out of the ballpark of reason.
No, and you know what's very exciting right now, Laura, and I know you've probably spoken about this with other guests, is the find that's off the coast of Cuba right now.
Yeah.
That's being investigated by the Russian-Canadian scientist Polina Zelitsky. What they have found is very sophisticated structures, it seems, there. But what's very interesting to me is the Cuban geologist that they're working with saying that originally Cuba was connected to the Yucatan, it was connected to Central America, and that landmass that's there may have sunk at least 15,000 to 50,000 years ago, which could mean that the civilization that they're looking at there is over 15,000 years ago, putting it right in the same ballpark that we're talking about ancient Africa.
You know, I don't know why we think that we're the first ones to be so sophisticated or to do anything unusual or what have you. If you really read some of the evidence that's left behind, you can see that there are so much evidence that humankind's been quite clever, quite sophisticated, quite aware of its environment and to manipulate it for many, many, many thousands of years.
I agree. It's a sort of ethnocentric bias that unfortunately pervades in academia, that everything has just reached its level within the last 10,000 years.
Yeah.
And that's nonsense. All the indigenous wisdom keepers talk about cycles. We know in the Vedas, mm-hmm. they talk about cycles that go back millions of years.
Right. It's a roller coaster ride, not just a gradual ascent to where we are today if we think we're so sophisticated. What is geologists and Robert Schock, a geologist in particular, say about when the West dry riverbed that was once this Nile, when was it active so we can start to pin a date on it geologically?
Yes. Well, we see there are periods which are called pluvials, which are rainy periods, and there's a distinct, very active period of rainfall in northern Africa that's about 50,000 to 30,000 years ago. Then there's a period of thousands of years of dry period. Then there's a wet period again. So we're looking, I would say, you know, in my opinion, the According to the indigenous tradition, the Sphinx was carved over 50,000 years ago. I believe the Great Pyramid, the pyramids at Giza, and the pyramids I discuss in my book were well over 10,000, perhaps over 20,000 years ago. So we're looking at a very lush green period between 50,000 to 30,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, where it was very lush and green, and this river was very active in northern Africa.
You know, that makes sense to me. You don't build a big, high civilization, in the middle of a desert. You've got to have that water source and further than just what the Nile can irrigate. And why now? Why at the end of cycles? What's the timing got to do with the indigenous elders saying, go ahead, Kakim, tell the story?
Right. Well, this is, again, this corresponds amazingly to so many indigenous teachings that are coming out from Mayan elders, Hopi elders, many Native American elders, who are saying that we are coming to the end now of many different cycles, not just one cycle. Of course, the Mayan calendar, we know, supposedly ends in December 21st, 2012. What Hakim is bringing forth is that we are coming to the end of a 4,000 to 6,000-year cycle now, which is called the Age of Amun, which, interestingly enough, is where the word amen comes from.
Like amen at the end of a prayer.
Right, but, you know, it's very, you know, Hakim teaches that just about everything we do today is reversed the way it originally was in the time period we're talking about. And this, interestingly enough, is something that also George Gurdjieff talked about. When he would say, he said, everything in the modern world is topsy-turvy.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say a prayer in the Christian religion, and we end it with amen, we're saying, let it be thy will be done. But actually, according to the Cretan tradition, it's saying, let it be in darkness. Because this cycle that we're talking about, the last 5,000 some odd years, is characterized by a time of darkness, of ignorance, of greed, of warfare, of patriarchy, which all the things, why the world is so out of balance today. So the key to bringing the teachings out now is they're saying we're coming to the end of the cycle. We're coming to the new dawn, which is characterized by Heper, the scarab beetle, which means the driller, which represents the dawn. The beetle pushes the sun in front of it, according to the commissions. And so we are coming to the end of darkness, and it's time that the indigenous traditions from peoples all around the world now be brought to the West, because the West is key to the future of humanity, and for people to have an understanding that we are going through a raising in consciousness now, and this is why the teachings are being brought out.
You know, that's such good news, because I knew this isn't the way that it was supposed to be. Since I was a kid, I've looked around the world and going, this is crazy. This isn't the way it's supposed to be.
So many of us felt the same way.
Yeah. So this is just a phase we were going through, and we're going to get out of it soon. Oh,
it really helps. Interesting. The phase of darkness, the phase of the last 5,000 years, is what Egyptology says was Egypt. Dynastic Egypt begins around 3,000 BC, around 5,000 years ago, and I'm saying to people, this was just a shadow, a pale shadow of what the civilization originally was.
How would you describe the civilization? What is the picture that is painted by the indigenous elders about what once was this golden age?
It's a phase of cycles, but beginning 65,000 years ago, we start to rise in consciousness. People go to sacred spots. Hakim always teaches why there are pyramids, why there are temples in certain spots.
Well, why are there?
Because the energy of the site dictates what's there. Because these sites usually have running water underneath it, they usually have a source of crystal, so they're natural energy fields. When he describes the Sphinx, he says originally it was what is called in geology a yardang, which means it was a limestone outcropping, just an undistinguishable group of limestone, but it was a sacred site. It was an energy zone. So he's saying over 56,000 years ago, people went there to energize themselves. Then they got the idea to make a carving there to represent the Great Mother. It does not represent a male king making an offering to the sun, but it's an aspect of the Great Mother, the creator of all. And then they started creating pyramids and temples. They were creating energy fields, using the natural energy that was there to amplify it, to utilize it, to use energy. Now, the people always ask us, the question one day that's asked to myself and Christopher Dunn about these things is, what did they use the energy for? Well, the answer is, what do we use energy for? We are biological systems. All systems need energy to survive, to create, to replicate, to duplicate, to exist. So energy...
If you can enhance your life force, you're ahead of the game.
Yes. And I tell people to use it in a vernacular that people might understand, is that pyramids were energy devices. They put temples next to the pyramids. What for? To just get high without the use of drugs, without the use of any psychoactive external substances, just to bathe in the energy fields, to raise consciousness, and we believe to understand that we're multidimensional beings so that they could communicate, know that existence is in many different levels of existence, and they could connect to those different dimensions using those energy fields.
Like the Vedas say that way back when in their golden age, there's people were in contact with all sorts of dimensions and intelligences and et cetera.
I see tremendous parallels with the Vedic teachings and what the ancient Commission teachings are.
Okay, so running water, tell us about those underground tunnels. I just want to preface by saying we have had Chris Dunn on, and his Giza power plant theory is really intriguing. We've also had, oh, I forget his name, the guy who's keeping alive the work of Edward Kunkel and his pyramid pump design.
Steve, yes.
Thank you. What is his name?
Stephen Myers.
Thank you. Sorry, Stephen. Stephen Myers. And so here's a lot of data coming together. I just met with J.J. Hertog, who was showing me photos of some big drill cores in the limestone under the pyramid, where they would have these waterways that point right to that western Nile, where it once was. And so you have this really elaborate system. People don't go to all this effort without having a very good reason. Chris believes that they were generating power, the way that we understand electrical power of some sort, somewhere on the spectrum, to run machines to make those drill cores into those fancy designs in this very hard stone. You know, the machining tool marks. Paul and I saw those too when we were in Egypt. So, you know, where do you go from let's just feel good to let's run a whole technology to do with power and changing our environment? And what is that Great Pyramid about anyway, according to Hakim? You know, all this mysterious solid state technology.
And the credit is due to you. Actually, Chris Dunn and I have become very close friends and colleagues, and the great synchronistic event is that you interviewed both of us on the same night in 1996 without each one of us knowing each other. And since then, we've become very close friends, and you've been very helpful in our research for both of us.
Oh, well, thank you. I hear that. You know, there's a reason why people fall on a certain day that you... I've always known that.
It's amazing, Laura. You actually, again, to give you the credit, you're the first person that gave me a major interview to reveal this work, and Christopher. And right, like 3 months after that interview, and it was November 1996, we met, and since have become very close friends and colleagues, and have been to Egypt together, and going to be in Egypt together again next January. Well, Chris's reason why I was attracted to Chris's work is that his theory fits right in the definition that Hakim was giving us. He's saying the word pyramid, a Greek word, pyramidos, which means fire in the middle, is based on the ancient term per neter. Per is house. Neter has been translated many different ways. The Egyptologists believe it means god or goddess. We think it means an aspect of consciousness, not deity as we think of deity. Mm-hmm. And Hakim also translated as sense, like in our senses. So what he's saying, we translate per neter as house of energy, house of nature, where the Greek word nature comes from, neter. So Chris is saying, yes, the Great Pyramid is a coupled oscillator. It's vibrating in a harmonic frequency of the Earth herself. It may have produced hydrogen gas, microwaves, radio waves. And Hakim gives us this broad definition, house of energy, house of nature. So with Stephen Myers, with many, many people have come up, we're constantly getting, Chris and I are both directors of research of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, and you have interviewed Dr. John DeSalvo, who's a great fellow, who's brought a whole team of international scientists together to bring all sorts of alternative theories about the Great Pyramid. And every day we're constantly having someone email us or send us information saying, well, I think the Great Pyramid did so-and-so, or I think the Great Pyramid did this. Well, this great umbrella definition that we have now, House of Energy, can fit many different functions. So the Great Pyramid had many functions. But one of the major functions that I see, according to what Hakim has taught us, is that they brought water in to use the water for the basis of the energy, catalytically converting it to hydrogen and oxygen, really stepping up the hydrogen gas to a tremendous level of energy. That gas could be converted into electricity, to all sorts of different energy fields. And there's no doubt that many different people have come up with tremendous theories now how the Great Pyramid would produce various types of energy fields. And we believe we have, if we can get funded, the means to test these things and actually demonstrate physically these energy fields that are still there today. Basically, as a power plant, as Chris Dunn states, the Great Pyramid ceased to function, I believe, maybe as far back as 10,000 years ago, something happened, an accident in the Great Pyramid, which we can document, and we hope to be able to document that even greater. It's amazing that each time we go back to Egypt, we see more and more evidence, and so I'm excited to go back with Chris again. He was just back last August, and he found more evidence to prove that there was an explosion in the Great Pyramid way back when, and it ended its function as a power plant, but it's still producing those energy fields, basic quantum energy fields today.
Okay, another researcher you should know about, an acoustics engineer named John Reed, just gave us an interview, and he's got a book called Egyptian Sonics, only available at the radio bookstore. And he's been doing Hans Jenny-like cymatic experiments and seeing hieroglyphic forms come out when he's vibrating a rubber drum that he placed over the sarcophagus, the granite box is a better term. So that's quite exciting.
And Stan Tenen has also done work in that area.
Oh, has he? Tell me what Stan's up to.
Stan Tenen believes that the sound frequencies would produce geometric forms that are the basis of all ancient alphabets, like Egyptian hieroglyphic, like Hebrew. And so that the sound actually does produce geometric forms, which is basically a lot of what Jenny was doing also.
Right. We've extensively interviewed Stan Tenen over the years, and so I knew he was looking at the Hebrew alphabet. I didn't know it was tying into
the Egyptian glyphics, too, sure.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yes.
So, also, the crystalline structure, Stannis told us for a long time that the very angle at which the crystals in the granite, this was the limestone, are angled are imitative of the various wall angles of this building itself and its design. So you have some resonance going on there.
Yeah, it's incredible. We did some preliminary sound experiments ourselves, and we believe that each pyramid was tuned to a different frequency, and they all work together in a grid that produces tremendous harmonic resonance.
What kind of experiments did you do to find out what this frequency
was? We did
some
vowel sounds, some chanting. We put it on audio tapes, processed it through synthesizers. We're able to produce overtones in multiple frequencies, and this is also based on a lot of the work that was done by acoustic engineer Tom Damley, the late Boris Said, who I know was a friend of yours. And he also said that he worked in the Great Pyramid, found that its particular frequency, well, we worked in the Red Pyramid at Dahshur, and we found that the pyramid there was based on a different frequency. So we think that all the pyramids may have worked together in some type of tremendous harmonic grid, each tuned to a different frequency, like different tuning forks, producing this tremendous harmonic resonance energy field.
You know, you wouldn't have to hear this either, or to know that this thing is going on, or itself a structure toning, much as a guitar is known, if you have sensitive microphones, to be giving off a tone just by the air running over its strings.
Right.
So the whole concept of a solid-state machine that's operating just by sitting there and existing is quite intriguing, isn't it?
Yes, and as you have mentioned, the particular material used, the limestone, which is a sedimentary rock full of anumolites, organic frequency, the particular granite, the rose quartz Aswan granite, which is 55% quartz crystalline, full of mica, these were not accidents that they chose these materials. It's because of their resonant abilities, the ability to resonate at these specific frequencies and amplify a basic sound. And so it was not by the whim of a megalomaniacal king that these structures were built. It was built for specific reasons by master engineers, priestesses, adepts.
I've heard this argument that while we can date the Sphinx as being very old because of the deep rivulets that can only be caused by torrential rain, a la Robert Schock's work, that a lot of people are now agreeing with the standard Egyptological view that the pyramid is only 4,500 years old.
Unfortunately, some of our well-known alternative researchers have gone that way, and I just can't understand it. Because, as I point out in my book, it's quite easy to see that the dynastic pyramids that were built, usually built out of mud brick, very small limestone blocks, were very inferior materials. To me, it seems obvious that it was a different civilization, a different culture that constructed these stonemasonry pyramids.
Given the culture that we know about and is so well documented 4,500 years ago in Egypt, there's no reason that they would build such an elaborate, mysterious structure as the Great Pyramid.
Right.
With all of that yet to be understood technology that's
well,
within
and again, as Christopher Dunn points out, the toolkits that we see that are presented by Egyptologists, the stone pounders and copper chisels,
yeah,
are woefully inadequate to accomplish the task. And when we talk about the drilling of the tunnels, I mean, this is why people are constantly bringing out to me, well, what about the theories that the pyramids were poured, that they were cast?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, the reason why I don't support that theory, there are many reasons, but the major reason is the tunnels. The tunnels show a tremendous ability of sophisticated engineering to drill straight through limestone bedrock, make almost right angles with smooth walls. Now, if you know, they want us to believe that they did that with stone pounders, I mean, somebody's going to have to demonstrate that.
You're referring to Joseph Davidovits and Margie Morris?
Yes.
I think that's an intriguing theory, and who knows?
Well, I think the theory has validity. There's no doubt that they had sophisticated use of cement. But,
mm-hmm.
Again, I think there's major flaws in trying to say all the granite, all the limestone was cast.
Margie's very clear about pointing out they don't think that all of them. They think just some of them.
Well, from what I've heard from Margie Morris lately, she's saying all of them.
Oh, well, she's changed since I've talked to her. But let's come back with Stephen Naylor and find out about those tunnels. Also, Stephen, if you would tell me, has anyone done any scouting about for finding any other ruins west of Giza where that Nile once flowed? Because it would seem to me there would be plenty along its former banks.
Yes.
That would be another rich area to look at. And more about these indigenous wisdom keepers who say this is a very old civilization, no surprise there. And perhaps there's lessons that we can apply from, again, one more ancient wisdom tradition to today if we can hold forth our own technology in a more spiritual and way working with nature. That's also one of the gifts that this would bring to us. And Stephen's book, The Land of Osiris, as well as John Reed's book on Egyptian phonics, as well as Chris Dunn's book, and all of these various interviews, all available at the radio bookstore at 800-243-1438 or radiobookstore.com. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
All interviews on The Laura Lee Show are available on audio cassette. For information, call 1-800-243-1438.
The Laura Lee Show is brought to you by the following sponsors. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend contains 50 phytonutrient-rich whole foods, whole food concentrates, vegetables, herbs, providing protein, essential fats, minerals, vitamins, and fiber, along with enzymes for ready digestibility. Add to vegetable juice, oatmeal, porridge, yogurt, applesauce, or soups, and can be sprinkled on virtually any food. Call 1-800-243-1438 for a special offer on Udo's Choice Wholesome Fast Food Blend. Or for links for more information, go to radiobookstore.com.
Hard to believe that an herb has the power to kill bacteria, viruses, and other pathogens, but the wild oregano growing in the Mediterranean does just that, and as effectively as prescription drugs. Numerous laboratory experiments demonstrate this power, yet oregano is safe and gentle on the body. North American Herb and Spice produces the finest, the purest, the most potent line of oregano products, Oregamax, Oregasin, and Super Strength Oil of Oregano. Read about the numerous lab studies, how to use oregano, and what it can do to protect your health against a wide range of common pathogens and parasites. It's all at oregamax.com. You can also call them direct at 800-243-5242 to place an order or find the store nearest you for your oregano products. A wild oregano, the most potent herb ever tested, yet gentle and safe. It's a great and wonderful gift of nature, and you can call 800-243-5242 and visit oregamax.com. Did you know enzymes are needed for each and every of the millions of biochemical reactions in our body? Past the age of 30, our body's natural production of enzymes slows down. That's why we need to supplement. I take Vitalzyme. It's the most complete and effective blend of enzymes with protease, serrapeptase, papain, bromelain, amylase, lipase, rutin, and amla. What do these enzymes do? They help so many vital functions. to balance our body's own repair mechanisms, regulate the formation of fibrin, cleanse the blood of debris, promote good blood circulation, maintain immune system health, and much, much more. Vitalzyme contains no animal derivatives, no artificial flavors or colors, and no talc, lactose, yeast, or gluten. For your supply of Vitalzyme and a free cassette of Dr. Will Wong's Systemic Enzyme Therapy, call World Nutrition at 800-548-2710. That's 800-548-2710. Let's get back to our conversation with Stephen Mailer. His new book, The Land of Osiris, presents great evidence and a new view on those ancient Egyptians. It's about time someone gave credit to a very old civilization for the wonders of the artifacts that they left behind. We don't always need to attribute it to Atlanteans or aliens. Speaking of Atlanteans, I agree that Atlantis is a code word for this ancient civilization. And so does Akeem, apparently, and so do you, Stephen. Give us just your take on Atlantis.
Yes, well, again, as we talked about, the find off the coast of Cuba, the find it off the of India, the Bay of Cambay, more and more evidence keeps coming up. So many people that you've interviewed over the years, like my great friend David Hatchett Childers, Gunnar Thompson, Michael Cremo, Richard Thompson, all have said that there was sophisticated civilization over 10,000 years ago all around the world. So instead of focusing, I mean, you get Rand and Rose Flamath saying it was in Antarctica. Every day somebody comes out saying Atlantis was the British Isles, was in Bolivia, the Altiplano of Bolivia. And I'm saying that it was a catchphrase for what I like to call the global maritime culture. Yeah. That over 10,000 years ago, there were sophisticated civilizations all around the world, and they were in contact. Sometimes it's a disagreement here, who came up with the original phrase, whether it was Gunnar Thompson or David Childers, but they both used the phrase that oceans are not barriers, they are highways. Mm-hmm. And basically we're seeing that transoceanic travel, I believe, is thousands and thousands of years older than is accepted in academia. So, Hakim's basic take was when we first discussed Atlantis, he was against it. And that really surprised me, because so many other things he was saying were indicated. But he's a profound Afrocentrist, and that he believes that Africa is the birthplace of humanity and of civilization. And any kind of theory that would talk about sophisticated civilization outside of Africa, he believed he wouldn't entertain, and he didn't like the idea of a racist way, perhaps, that some groups use a theory of Atlantis, that enlightened white people escaping a doomed continent in the Atlantic came to Africa and taught these ignorant people of color how to build in stone and gave them the trappings of civilization. He totally rejected that. And when we reposited the theory and talked about it in greater detail, if we included Kemet, ancient Kemet, as being a major part of the equation, as being part of the global maritime culture, i.e. Mm-hmm. Atlantis, then he could accept it. Okay, the people came from all around the world into Africa, traded, exchanged, and then he could understand that there was a civilization all around the world. But if Africa wasn't part of the equation, he wouldn't hear it. And so, in my opinion, I think we're going to constantly keep finding things like the find off of Cuba, et cetera, that are going to keep showing that advanced civilization existed in many different areas of the world prior to 10,000 years ago, and that's where Atlantis came from. I believe that Plato, using Solon as his source, went to ancient Kemet, to Egypt, and was initiated there and was told these histories and couched it in the term of Atlantis.
Makes sense.
Africa was where it was.
Yep. And I've heard that the Egyptians of ancient times themselves said that they came from two previous advanced civilizations.
Right.
Yeah.
They didn't say where, but interesting is that when we break it down the way I see it, it almost makes sense to what all the theories say. I see that ancient northern Africa over 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, was a series of large islands. This ancient Ur-Nil River, I believe, was over 100 miles across, thousands of miles long, and had many tributaries, which I think broke up all of northern Africa into large islands. So what we see is, as the people coalesced, as the 42 tribes came together, they island hopped. They went from one island to another. They started building pyramids and temples. And this is where the idea is of one going from island to another. And there was cataclysms. There's no doubt in my mind that a lot of the evidence shows around 11,500 years ago, there was a worldwide cataclysmic event.
Well, the Ice Age ended, so there was a lot of flooding. We know that.
Yes.
And who knows what else. Okay, a couple of questions. To do with Atlantis, there's the Edgar Cayce concept that long ago the Atlanteans tuned their crystals too high and had a blowout. You're saying that some time ago there's evidence that in the King's Chamber in particular there was some sort of accident and disruption and blackened walls and blown out kind of walls and all of this. I suppose you could, I mean, look at what the pyramid looks like. It looks like a giant crystal. This, you know, could that have been a metaphor for that accident?
Well, absolutely. This is indicated in David Hatchett-Trovis's latest book, where he actually talks about these things. That we used to talk about the Great Pyramid as perhaps being a radio station, also sending radio waves all around. And we talked about perhaps there was an antenna coming off the top of the Great Pyramid. That's why it wasn't capped. And Hakim would look at us and say, "That's the antenna. The Great Pyramid itself. It is a giant crystal." And you know, Laura, it's a very interesting thing. I am actually discussing this in great detail with David Childress right now, that there seems to be somewhere around maybe 10 to 12,000 years ago, not only was there a cataclysmic event, but there may have been some type of wars that went on around the world. Of course, the Vedas, the Mahabharata are full of these things, where some terrible weapons were used. And, you know, that's the fall of Atlantis, was the misuse of its power. It may be that we're going to come up with some real distinct evidence that this is not just myth, metaphor. It may have been relating to actual events. They just recently found a city in India where people were vaporized. They didn't find corpses. They only found outlines like they did at Hiroshima. And they have found layers of radioactive ash. Like, they, you know, it seems obvious that this city was destroyed by some nuclear blast thousands and thousands of years ago.
Where did they find this in India?
Oh, I don't know exactly where. I think it's in northern India. I can get the reference for you. And I saw.
And would nuclear blast lines, you know, remain that long?
They found evidence of
nuclear vaporizing. I've heard that. I've heard of radioactive sands and the heating up of sand so hot that those tektites are formed.
That's called the green glass.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it's been found in many different areas in the world. And, of course, Zachariah Sitchin talks about this a lot. Mm-hmm. And I had tended to not take it seriously enough, but I'm starting to look at this. And mm-hmm. with the accident that we know happened in the Great Pyramid, we see evidence not only in the King's Chamber, but in the Grand Gallery itself.
What is the evidence in both chambers there?
Okay, in the King's Chamber, we see the walls are actually separating from the floor, that they've been pushed outward. Mm-hmm. The great evidence is that the granite blocks on the ceiling are cracked. Now, Egypt has blamed that as part of an earthquake. However, mm-hmm. I have been down in the lower chambers and in the descending passageway, and there's no evidence of earthquake damage there, which should be if it was an earthquake because mm-hmm. it's closer to the epicenter.
Okay.
So it seems like the granite blocks on the ceiling of the King's Chamber were thrown up, thrust up, and then crashed back down and cracked. But the great evidence that we've just discovered now in the Grand Gallery is burn marks on the ceiling, burned right into the limestone, burn marks on the northern wall of the Grand Gallery that's blackened, and it's granite there too. It's not just limestone, it's turned black. It would take tremendous heat and pressure to have explosion to have caused that. And we also believe, and Chris Dunn is the only one who has explained why the stone box, as you correctly mentioned, in the King's Chamber is a chocolate color. It's normally a rose Aswan granite. It should be rose colored, pinkish colored, but it is chocolate colored today. No one's ever tried, Egyptologists, to explain it. It would take tremendous heat to have turned that granite that color.
It would be interesting to take some of that Aswan granite and start to do experiments with it, and how much heat would it take to turn it that particular color and such.
That's a great idea.
That seems doable. Let's see. I just want to also mention some folks that were in here just the other day, Jay Wakefield and Renaud DeYonga, who wrote a very interesting book, Tracing the Sun God to the Americas, and this extensive navigation system from the megalithic culture. So, I mean, when you think of 10,000 years ago, the megalithic culture was, what, 6,000 years ago?
Right.
We're talking from many different angles. People are finding this evidence that navigation was widespread, that it was sophisticated, that it was a network, that they used a common language and common tools, and they left the marks in petroglyphs and other kind of evidence and the Stone Spheres of Costa Rica as part of this, and it was just a global system. It's so exciting.
Right.
And if we only had left our monuments intact everywhere, we would have a lot more evidence to put this piece of the puzzle together. I want to mention their book's also available at the radio bookstore. So tell me about the tunnels that lead down to these water systems and what we're finding in terms of drill cores, very long, perfectly round tunnels through this rock under the Giza Plateau. Describe it there.
I was personally able to investigate tunnels under the Giza Plateau and at Saqqara. And so we know at least that the tunnels, I think, went from Saqqara to Giza, which would be about 8 miles. But when I talk about in my book, The Land of Osiris, which is a series of sites from Dahshur to Abu Awash, that's covering about 25 square miles. And I believe there were tunnels under all these sites that connected and may have gone miles and miles out into the west. What it seems is that to create the active living sites that once eventually were there, that they channeled into natural channel systems, underground waterways, to bring water from the west to the eastern sites to create the civilization for the energy, for the agriculture, and that the tunnels are very sophisticated. Just the few that I have been able to see, the walls are incredibly smooth. It looks like it would be, I mean, we've actually done those things today. I've seen some evidence of some of the tunnels that some of the so-called secret government supposedly has, that it looks like gigantic drill cores that just would gouge away. Well, you know, we think that they use some type of ultrasonic machining, drill bits that were vibrating at tremendous frequencies to go right through the limestone cores. And it's amazing that, now a lot of people have asked about halls of records. Well, it could be that some of the tunnels, some of the chambers, I know you talked about Jim Hertek, I know him well too, he's a friend of mine, that there are rooms that there may be evidence is found. But Hakim was very adamant that the primary reason for the majority of the tunnels that we investigated were for water, to bring running water in, running water creating those energy fields, and the water interacting with the stone, the igneous rock, with the crystal to produce energy fields. And so we actually think, and again, I have to give you credit for this. You helped me very much in my research on Victor Schauberger by sending me some videos of Callum Coates. And it was tremendous how Schauberger talks about how the Earth is like the natural arterial vascular system of the Earth, or these underground passageways where water runs, and water is the blood system of the Earth. Well, what we see is what the ancient Phoenicians did is they imitated the natural waterways, serpentine, moving in angles like waters, like rivers do, for the water to reach its maximum energy fields, and they connected the artificial tunnels that they were drilling to the natural water tunnels to bring the water in a beautiful system that's based on a natural understanding.
And Callum's one of the world's leading authorities on the work of Victor Schauberger, and his videos and books we have as well. He's a wonderful guy.
Yes, he is. Those videos were very informative to me, I think.
My husband Paul shot that video.
Oh,
and produced that. Yeah,
great.
It's his work. Okay, how big are the tunnels? Because how do you, without them being the size of a human being, how do you get machinery down there and go through solid rock from point A to point Z? I mean, how big are they?
The tunnels are all different sizes. And easily, one of the ones I was in was about at least 10 feet high, maybe about 6 feet wide. So it was easily enough for a man, a couple of human beings to stand in and drill through. But some of the stories I've heard and not seen yet, but we know that one definite proof we have is that Dr. Zahi Hawass, a couple of years ago on national television, showed a tunnel system underneath the Giza Plateau, only about 100 feet down, which he claimed was the tomb of Osiris. He presented no evidence to show that it was a tomb of anyone, but it was a central room where all different tunnels were coming into, like the spokes of a wheel, and this was a huge room, tremendous room. So we're looking at a tremendous amount of tunneling that was done. So, and also I mentioned my book, who I discussed with you a couple of years ago, J.O. Kinnaman. He talked about a room underneath the Great Pyramid that could seat 1,500 people. It was a large antechamber, like meeting room. So some of the tunnels are small, where a person has to crawl down through. Some of them are huge, where tons of people could fit in. So they're all different sizes, all different shapes.
So think civic plumbing.
Yes.
Project, as opposed to one pharaoh's tombs for his many sons or something.
Exactly, and you know, the Egyptologists tried to dismiss these tunnels as they would use them as trial passages for the pyramid or the. Actually, on Zahi Hawass's website, he says that they were swimming pools for the dynastic people. I mean, things like that. And they laugh at our theories.
Okay, swimming pools. Although in one of the temples, I think it was Kumumbo, we saw some really neat waterways that John West, who was our guide, was saying was hydrotherapy, that they would run water along this open plaza to heat it up from the sun, and then they were actually kind of hot tub step things where they'd put the water in, you could see the filter where it would come in, and they'd use it for hydrotherapy, and it was a healing temple, so
absolutely.
It fit in perfectly.
And I think that the whole idea of hot and cold running water is not a modern phenomenon. I think it's been around for thousands and thousands of years.
Dimenjo Daro, however you can say it,
yes.
Also had hot and running, cold running water.
And in Crete, yes.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so these extensive tunnels running under the... Why would you build the pyramids where they were unless the current Nile was simply a tributary of this huge Nile to the west? But why would you run these great pyramids where you wanted to bring the water miles away from your water source if indeed these go back so far, and this older Nile was the primary Nile at the time that they were built?
Well, again, these sites had particular energy fields naturally connected with them because of the limestone, because
mm-hmm.
of the igneous rock that was there.
So it's
there.
Worth running the water to where you wanted the other attributes that make up a sacred site.
That is correct.
Okay.
They were already known as being sacred sites from an mm-hmm. antiquity that goes so far back we can't even date it. So the sites were already known as sacred areas where people would go to get energized. So then to put the pyramids and temples there would just amplify the natural fields that are there.
Talk about what the megalithic people that we know best, those from the British Isles, were doing. They were following the ley lines.
Right.
They were creating standing stones that were enhancing the energy such that they're still active today. People hear voices, feel vibrations. Certain times of year, mysterious things go on. The stories go that you would enhance earth energy, telluric energy, by doing these things. So it would make perfect sense that other indigenous societies would be keen on earth energy and start to use it.
And then using sound, then using the toning, mm-hmm. chanting, using instruments,
singing.
Vibrating
mm-hmm.
machine discs made out of stone that create what we would consider music, but to the sacred sound, all working together in that amplification.
I should play this tape sometime. I believe it's on our website somewhere, where Paul drug around recording equipment when we were in Egypt, and we were toning as a group
right.
in all these various chambers. But when we got to the king's chamber, we sounded like a choir of angels.
Absolutely.
And I asked John Reed about that. You know, what is the attributes? And he said, well, it's the standing wave and the resonance cavity, and it just sort of cuts and vices the sound waves to stack them up so they sound harmonic.
That's right.
You can't miss in that chamber.
That's right. I think it's the most perfectly acoustic chamber in the world.
Yeah, well. So can you go to where this old Nile is, and can you find resulting tunnels? Would they be buried?
Well, we did. In 1998, one mm-hmm. of the last things, you know, Hakim said it to establish the theory, we had to go out into the western desert, and we visited the four major oases that are there today. It's Bahariya, Farafra, Dakhla, and Karga, and we found evidences of water still being used by the people there today to produce energy. We found certain temples that were built much later, like in Ptolemaic Greek periods around 300 BC that were built on top of older temples. We found the evidence that the water was underneath. So we found, we believe, some information. I know we can find more data if more rigorous work was done. I always say that if the funding was ever there for me and my group, we could do some excavations that would definitely make headlines. But we did find evidence that that's where the water came from, that it was not by accident that the Greeks and Romans went out there and built their oases, their resort areas in what was once the ancient civilization, because the water is still flowing underneath the ground, still producing energy. It was amazing to see the oases in Egypt today where there's no rainfall. Some places there's 4 inches of rain a year, and yet they're growing every possible crop that you can imagine, all grains, fruits, vegetables, because of the underground water table, which is still there today.
Are you suggesting that the underground water table, which I've heard is still soaking up a lot of artifacts the moment you go, you know, anywhere down and dig down in. I mean, it's wet there.
Right.
Are you suggesting it's not just a natural phenomenon? Because we know that there are rivers that flow underground through the crevices and through the more porous rock and all of that. But that it's those oases are the beneficiaries of the remnants of former water nexus points where water was flowing.
Well, again, that would take some excavation.
You don't know, but
it would take some excavation to find. I hypothesize that the tunnels went way out into the desert, hundreds of miles. So
what reason?
to bring the water in from the west, to get their natural water table with the natural waterways connecting them to the tunnels that they were drilling to bring them to the different sites, to make a whole arterial or vascular system of underground waterways, bringing water to all the sites, not only for the agriculture, but for the production of energy.
Okay, let's talk about the energy. Gary Hawkins, a good friend and guest, has been telling us about Brown's gas, where you take water and you separate the hydrogen and the oxygen, and it makes, and you combine it, and it burns and all of this. So there's some miraculous things you can do with water, and it's easily separated.
Yes.
Those clay jar batteries, I asked him, do they produce enough volts to do this? And he goes, yeah, you just need 1 or 2 volts, and you hook a bunch of these together, and you've got, you know, a lot of electricity that you could generate. So tell us, you've been probably working with some physicists to do with energy and alternative energy and what water could do for that. What's the story on how to create energy from water, other than the hydroelectrics that we do today?
Well, we do have some people that are working on actually the dynamics of it and documenting it, but it's just a matter of the water flowing over the rock produces these vibratory energy fields, and we believe a warm water and a cold water mixed together. And we actually have a member of our group, the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. He's an engineer named John Cadman, and he is working on some sophisticated diagrams and flow charts to show that he believes the underground chambers, the lower chambers in the Great Pyramid, which is called the pit or the subterranean chambers, is where the water came in, where the reaction occurred that catalytically converted it into oxygen and hydrogen. And he's actually going to maybe... if we can get the funding to put together some working models for that, so we can actually demonstrate that the structure of the Great Pyramid as it is today could still be used in smaller models to produce hydrogen gas, to produce these energy fields. Now, how is it exactly broken down? We have to work more on the dynamics, how it, you know, actually was separated. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it wouldn't take much of an energy electrical charge to catalytically convert water to oxygen and hydrogen. And we believe that the water flowing through such long distances, flowing through not only limestone, but granite and basalt, was amped up to such a high degree that it wouldn't take much to separate it at that point. And we just have to work on the actual dynamics. But, you know, I don't think we're going to be too far off. We're going to have working models of this.
Those chambers are so rough cut, and they're an odd shape, and they're just curious, those lowest chambers that we can get to, at least. And some people say that they were left to the mass that would then help to tune them into resonance and this, that, and the other. What does Hakim say about those chambers?
You know, and specifically, he's saying that there's nothing by accident. Just like the bent pyramid at Dahshur is not an accident. The fact that the chambers are rough cut are not an accident. That they're actually, that's the form that's needed to produce the fields. And it doesn't go into detail, but that's basically it, that nothing was by accident. So everything is designed for a purpose and fits that way, and this is how John Cadman is working his models, using those rough, and he believes definitely because of the rough design is what enabled the energy fields to be produced, not smooth.
Because of the rough design.
Right. So it has to do somehow with the interaction of the fields. And it's something that we're going to work on. Like we know, and also with the resonance. I think it has to do with the harmonic resonance. It's like the upper chambers in the King's Chamber. The lower sides of the granite are smooth, polished. Flinders Petrie was the first to observe this. But on the top of it, it's all rough cut. Now, you know, again, the Egyptologist was saying in the beginning, well, they just didn't finish it. Nonsense.
Yeah.
If they could smooth the bottom, of course, they could have smoothed the top. So obviously it's for the harmonic resonance. It has to do with the acoustic effect. And I once showed a diagram of the five of the chambers, so-called relieving chambers, they're not relieving chambers, the five chambers above the King's Chamber to an acoustical engineer. And he said, well, it acts like an acoustic comb filter. That's why it's designed that way.
So we know that they were sophisticated users of acoustics and sound waves and energy and
absolutely,
all of that. So, and just because we don't recognize what a technology is doesn't mean that they didn't and were using it. We're just a little bit slow in the curveball here for some of this more subtle stuff.
What's great is the advances that we've been able to accomplish in the last 100 years or so are now enabling us to see how sophisticated the people are. Like, one of the great scientists that we're working with in our group is a Ukrainian theoretical physicist named Vladimir Krasnolohovets, and he's saying that he can actually demonstrate that the Great Pyramid produces quantum energy fields, and that he can measure it, and that the builders of the Great Pyramid had a knowledge of quantum theoretical physics that we're only just approaching today.
So what would a quantum energy field be, actually?
Well, what he's saying is that what he calls its inertron fields. What he's saying is that they, in opposition to what Einstein postulated, that there's no such thing as dead space, that everything is small quantum particles that are colliding and creating energy fields. And now he's claiming that not only does he can measure a baseline inertron field in the Great Pyramid, which would be just a natural background field from the quantum particles colliding, but that he can demonstrate, he believes, theoretically, that the Great Pyramid is pulsing these inertron fields, which means that it is actually designed to use this basic inertron field and amp it up, charge it, use it, put it out in different ways to use that energy. And he claims he has a device that can measure this. That's another project for us to get to Egypt to do.
It's very exciting.
It is.
So we have a link to your website, and there's a lot of great researchers, and it's fun to have a whole network of people doing their specialty and collaborating and trying to put this very big puzzle on the table and to clarify. So where do you go from here? Do you have a trip coming up, and
In January, Chris Dunn and I are part of a conference put on by Power Places Tours and Conferences called Mysteries of the Spirit, which will also feature a well-known Matthew Fox and Dr. Hank Wesselman. We're going to be doing lectures and doing on-site research, showing people the actual physical evidence of our theories. And as many times as we can keep going back to Egypt, every time we go, we find more evidence.
How are the authorities cooperating with you? Sometimes they don't like certain theories and has been known to block it. West talks a lot about that.
And unfortunately, that is true. I could say that there's certain sites that I mentioned in my book that I was able to visit, which are not open to the public, and which are, since they found out that a lot of alternative groups or different groups were going to some of these areas, they are closed off now. So, unfortunately, that's the way things are. Hakim always says there's always a way. So we always can find a way to get somewhere if we have to. But unfortunately, to be able to take groups of people to certain of these areas, some of them are being closed and blocked. And it's unfortunate that it is that way, that they're not as open-minded as one would think scientists are supposed to be, that they keep their own paradigms locked in and they discourage. But, we go sometimes without an agenda. We go without a... we're low profile, and we're able to go in the back door or sneak around and get in and see these things and get the evidence.
How extensive is this indigenous elder network that Hakim is a part of? How many members?
It is very, well, I don't think there's any number on it, but I know that every time we would go to an area, to a site, and when people always talk about the guardians, they're always in native dress. They're always in galabeas. They're not in Western dress as Egyptologists giving tours. These are the people of the guardian of the sites. People tend to dismiss them. They think they're only out to try to get bakshish or money from you to show you things. But he calls them the keepers, that this tradition is handed down. He is unique in that he is Western trained and that he speaks so many different languages. And so that's why he's chosen to be the one. A lot of the other keepers that I met don't even speak English, but they meet in secret. They meet in caves, they meet in secret areas, and they share their information because they're outside these Islamic cultures, so they have to be careful, they have to be watchful. But it is very extensive. Every site, everywhere we went in Egypt, he pointed out keepers to us. So
I couldn't give you a number. Sounds like something for a Spielberg movie, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The next Indiana Jones.
It is.